KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I am excited for two reasons. The main reason is our guest today, Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School and Oliver Day of the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, and we'll be on discussing their article forthcoming, The Hacker's Aegis, Protecting Software Security Research Against Intellectual Property. A popular topic on this show are times and places where intellectual property law gets in the way of what many consider to be the proper role of intellectual property, or where intellectual property law just needs to be fixed or refined. One of the two major topics we've discussed on this show in the past have been the role of the hacker, a term that some find pejorative, but this prototypical and almost mythical character that is able to break into computers and change things and fix things or steal things and do all kinds of stuff. And there's a terminology around hacking, including white hat hackers and black hat hackers and those that don't even like the word hacker and choose other terms and so forth. In The Hacker's Aegis, Derek and Oliver take a close look at security research and software security research in particular, where they are concerned that intellectual property law is preventing those that would actually improve security from doing so because of the risks of liability. And in their article, they suggest certain solutions to those problems, both legal, social, and market-based, as they identify them. We're going to be talking broadly about who hackers are and what they are concerns are in particular in this article, and then talk about some of these security issues and proposed solutions. And I'm very excited to have them on, having seen them present a version of this article at an intellectual property conference in the past year. In listening to their presentation and hearing the questions that occurred afterwards, it occurred to me pretty quickly that I thought this would be a great topic to discuss on the show. And having enjoyed their presentations, I thought they'd be good radio guests. And so I'm looking forward to having them here. By way of very quick introduction, Derek Bambauer is an assistant professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, where he teaches internet law and intellectual property. He's a former principal systems engineer at Lotus Development, which is a part of IBM. He was also, in the past, a research fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet Society at Harvard, where he was involved in the Open Net Initiative, which is a project that I've followed, focusing literally on censorship in a variety of countries that are known to be active censors, among them China, Iran, and Vietnam. He's also published a number of articles in different journals and is someone that I think is certainly highly regarded within the field. His co-author, Oliver Day, is a researcher currently at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, where he focuses on the Stop Badware project, another project with which I'm familiar, and the title of it, I think, is quite appropriate. It tells you what it is about, going after a variety of software and websites that do things that most consumers would not want them to do. The prototypical idea of badware, at least in my view, is the classic spyware, the surreptitious download application that starts allowing people or computers to grab data from your computers. He has a background in security consulting, and he's currently an undergraduate candidate at the Harvard School of Extension, where he focuses on East Asian culture and history. He's an active member of Harvard Free Culture and the Free Software Foundation. The other point I want to make quickly, for those of you who listen to the show regularly, you know that I do the interviews by telephone. I did want to note that I am transitioning a bit by using Skype, at least on my end, rather than the traditional telephone-to-telephone that I've done. I would encourage any feedback on the engineering quality or sound quality of the show as you listen, but I'm that's a side note to the major focus, which is our discussion today with Derek and Oliver. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today and Hearsay Culture.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us, Dave. It's exciting.
Let's start off, Derek, and I'll start off with you, and Oliver, I'll ask the same question, but Derek, perhaps you can start. I always ask this question of my authors, which is, how did you become interested in the topic about which we're discussing today? So broadly, how did you become interested in hackers?
So from really two directions. One is having done just the slightest bit of it myself when I was at Lotus, although in deference to IBM's big blue philosophy, I should probably call it security research. I think hacking might lend the wrong connotation, which is something that we'll probably chat about a little later on.
Uh-huh.
And just finding it a fascinating topic is to sort of probe weaknesses, to look for holes in a company's computer defenses and systems, if you will, is it's an enormously intellectually rewarding challenge. And it's also something that when I got to law school, I realized might well have been illegal. Absolutely a lot of fun as a topic. And then really the other half of it is from getting to know Oliver and working with him at the Berkman Center and starting to realize that there is a culture and just a group of extremely smart people out there who this is what they do for fun and for profit. And, again, once you become a lawyer, you start seeing these people less as artists than as vandals. And when Oliver and I started talking about this, we realized that this is actually not that accurate, that our sort of impulse as lawyers to kind of quash this type of activity really can get in the way of some enormously valuable research and thinking. And so it's with that, with just the sort of briefest technical exposure and a lot of time spent thinking about the law on this, that I decided that what Oliver and I really need to do is to sit down and write this piece and lay out our thinking.
Oliver?
So I'm sorry, is the question how did I become interested in hacking or in the law of hacking?
Well, you know, I think given that, and I should put this disclaimer for you up front, that there are two of the three people you're going to hear today are lawyers. Derek and I are lawyers. Oliver, I know you are not. So I will ask you perhaps that question a little more broadly, hacking and the law of hacking, given that you're exploring the law.
With hacking, I was just it just kind of happened by accident that in the 90s it was just something of interest. It was a hobby, and it turned into a very lucrative and legal career for me. And as I got into the I guess the logistics of my career, I realized there was a lot of legal minefields, and I saw colleagues of mine facing very, very kind of awkward lawsuits, and it kind of dawned on me that it just seemed wrong. And as I got involved with the Berkman Center, I was just very lucky in that I had access to a lot of very, very bright cyber lawyers, and they're very rare in the field. And I started asking these questions, and apparently it was something that they hadn't even figured out yet, and that the law hasn't even figured out yet. And what drew me into hacking is kind of what's drawing me into cyber law, which is this kind of undefined frontier. And that's the kind of challenge that I've always kind of readily accepted.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Oliver, and I know, as I mentioned in the introduction, Derek, you teach internet law. I teach internet law as well at my school, and that's one of the things that I point out to the students up front, which is that if you're looking for an area of law that in many ways is still being written, where fundamental questions have yet to be answered conclusively, this is a good area of law to be in. And I guess it transitions us a little bit, still kind of top level talking about your piece, but perhaps a general state of the law with regard to hackers might be helpful. Now, I'm not asking you to tell me every law that involves hackers, but as we think about the development of the law or how developed the law is, what is hackers or law that pertains to hackers look like right now, Derek? What's the current status in your mind?
In my mind, almost everything that a hacker does puts them at legal risk. So we have things such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which really, speaks about exceeding authorized access to a protected computer, which is really any computer connected to the internet, is potentially a criminal violation. You have floating out there the risk of things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and its ban on bypassing certain types of digital rights management schemes. You have the possibility of civil claims for things like trespass or trespass to chattels, a variety of other sort of torts. And then you have the sort of garden variety intellectual property claims. So if you are a hacker, you really have to sort of wend your way between Scylla and Charybdis just in order to earn your daily bread. And that's absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that's interesting is that hackers deliberately, I think, cultivate this sort of mythos about them, right, which is that they are living on the edge of the law. And the fun part about it for me is that they're really not. They are way over the edge of the law most of the time. And yet we also take it for granted that this type of testing, the type of work that they do, which reveals flaws in sort of widely used software, whether it's Windows or Internet Explorer or Adobe Acrobat or something like that, is enormously socially valuable. It's the only way we figure out, for example, the way that Chinese agents are able to break into Gmail, Google's email service. And so we have this strange dichotomy where the state of the law is that virtually everything they do is illegal, but it's also enormously useful that they're doing it. And that's a fun contrast.
Oliver, the terminology hacker, as I mentioned, and Derek referred to, is itself, and the name hacker, controversial. As Derek and you conceive it in this article, who or what is a hacker?
Right. It's a fun kind of history for the word, right? I mean, I've been in cabs and I've seen a hacker license, and apparently it used to mean you drove a cart with a horse. But now everyone seems to think it means you are this criminal mastermind that can siphon out millions of dollars from Bank of America and disappear into the Caribbean. But that's actually not entirely true anymore, right? It's been decades, really, since the hacker has kind of entered mainstream consciousness. And in the paper, like Derek and I, we really kind of suggest that we transition some of these terms. And in what we're talking about, right, which is the people that are out there and they are finding flaws in Internet Explorer or other very, very important pieces of software, those people are more security researchers, right? And the term, you know, hacker is maybe reserved for, in the 90s, the term was cracker, which is someone that is capable of infiltrating someone's network and maybe, you know, exfiltrating data from it. Whereas, you know, what we're mainly concerned about is, you know, the ability to find and talk about important software vulnerabilities in things that will, you know, eventually let, you know, say a, you know, some Chinese agent get into Google or to Adobe or something like that.
The part of the background here, and I think it's an interesting one, especially those who aren't familiar with this topic, is perhaps I can relate a very quick story, which is literally the day that I started the fellowship at Stanford when I was there for a couple of years, my boss, Jennifer Granick, mentioned to me, or during that week, I should say, mentioned to me that she was representing a hacker whose name will now escape me, but I'm sure when I tell
the
story.
Mike Lynn.
Yes, exactly. Mike Lynn. Thank you, Derek. Mike Lynn, who had been accused by Cisco of violating a ton of rights that Cisco claimed to have, including trade secrecy, which became an interest of mine and remains my primary scholarly focus, violated trade secrets of Cisco by discovering a flaw in their routers and then publicizing that flaw at a significant hackers conference, and this got very serious and very problematic for Lynn quickly, where the potential for criminal prosecution, not to mention of course civil litigation brought by Cisco, and it struck me immediately that here we had an individual whose purpose in at least from what I could tell, whose purpose in doing this work was to reveal a significant vulnerability in these routers that are used, of course, throughout the world. As one of the backbone infrastructures for the internet. And rather than being interested, it appeared, in discovering that flaw and solving it, Cisco seemed to take the position that no one should know about it in the first place. And so that leads me to, again, a top-level question before we get into the issues that you discuss here, which is this fundamental debate that seems to exist within the security world from the technology standpoint, and that's whether security is improved by transparency or by secrecy. So, you know, perhaps Oliver, I'll start with you, and Derek, I'm sure you have an opinion on this as well. What's your view on that fundamental issue?
You know, my view's changed quite a bit over the years, but primarily I would say that the transparency helps more than it hurts. You know, when I was younger, my gut told me that transparency was the way to go, and you should not hide anything. And you know, over the last decade or so, I've had a lot of chance to kind of reflect on, you know, historically what's happened. And it seems that my gut reaction was pretty accurate. You know, with Microsoft, right, and Jennifer Granick wrote a wonderful paper on this topic. Transparency in their security flaws has helped their software improve at least 100-fold, right? They have gone from being the biggest security embarrassment in the software world to probably one of the more revered security, I guess, as far as their security apparatus, it's very much revered among the security researchers, right? And not just because it's more open, but because all of the low-hanging fruit are gone, right? As a security researcher, you want to find really easy things that can be exploited quickly and that you can talk about. But with Microsoft, it's very difficult now. All those things were found back in the 90s, and now it takes a very, very skillful person to find a flaw inside of Microsoft products. And, you know, when you look at people that hide their flaws, let's say Oracle, you know, it seems that their products have not improved very much, and the low-hanging fruit are always still there because they refuse to kind of accept what has been kind of agreed upon as the industry's best practice. And just to be clear, you know, I'm very much in favor of responsible disclosure, which is kind of a mix of, you know, full disclosure, but also with, you know, a little bit of I guess, secrecy. You know, you keep it secret up to a certain point where, you know, there's going to be an advantage to the public, right? So you keep it secret while there's no patch out. And then once the patch has been developed and released, then you tell everyone about it to make sure that they all understand the importance of installing that patch.
Derek?
From my perspective, I think Oliver has hit it exactly right, which is that I start from the proposition, and you know there is empirical data to back this, that transparency works. So security through obscurity simply does not function. And the history of, for example, encryption research, I think, proves that fairly potently. And when Oliver and I think about this, you know, one of the things is it's a very difficult subject because it's not a dichotomy between sort of transparency and secrecy, that there's a continuum there. And so what Oliver's talking about with responsible disclosure is somewhere along that continuum, that in many ways it actually matters sort of where you are in terms of time. So the idea of just sort of announcing a vulnerability as soon as it's discovered means that you set off an arms race between essentially the black hat hackers who are going to try to exploit it, the people at the vendor who are trying to code a fix for it, and the people who are at customer sites who then have to install that fix. So in many ways, transparency depends on where you are in terms of time in the cycle and the process. And so it's worth thinking about not only the idea that the balance between transparency and secrecy varies with time, but also that it actually is a prod. It's a weapon, right, that if you're a security researcher, you're going to use in trying to push a vendor to take a problem that you found seriously, which is, okay, if you don't think it's all that serious, then perhaps what I should do is just disclose it to the public, right, and sort of let them take protective measures. On the other hand, if they say, no, you shouldn't actually release it because it's harmful, then that's actually a pretty potent argument for saying that they ought to do something about it. They ought to put the effort into patching it. So this idea of sort of transparency is a very powerful one, but it's also extremely nuanced.
Should I as a consumer be concerned about the Mike Lynn Cisco situation?
From my perspective, you probably should in two ways. One is that we just take the transport mechanisms, right, the transport layer of the internet for granted, that I try to load CNN.com in my browser, and somewhere out in the cloud, CNN's website sends me the page, and whatever happens in between, I'm not all that concerned about. But a lot of important stuff happens in between. And so what Mike proved was that there might be essentially a massive widespread vulnerability in the system that could disrupt not only my ability to load CNN, but could disrupt E911 calls over VoIP and e-commerce, sharing of electronic medical records or telemedicine. That, in other words, he found a vulnerability in sort of the very core of the internet. And the second is actually, it's a sort of a fun thing for somebody who teaches trademark, which is it's about brand, it's about reputation. Cisco's routers were the best and the sort of most widely selling, not just because of their sort of technical prowess, but also because they were bulletproof. These were things that you just could not hack. You could not execute arbitrary code on a Cisco router. Lin found a way. And so in some senses, it really should be a wake-up call, not only to people in sort of corporate IT departments who are buying this stuff, but to all of us, that we need to be a little bit less trusting that everything is going on okay between your computer and whatever other computer you're trying to talk to.
We're talking with Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, as well as Oliver Day of Harvard's Berkman Center on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, gentlemen, I think with that general background, and hopefully with the Lin scenario perhaps being an example of what we're talking about, let's chat a bit about the article that you're working on. And I should say up front two things. First, that we're recording this interview on January 15th, 2010, and secondly, that the article remains a work in progress. It is not yet been published. With respect to the article, and I think we've talked about it a little bit, but when we say when you focus on protecting software security research against intellectual property, gentlemen, I'll leave it to you to answer the question as you choose. Are we talking about the Lin situation, or is it, as Derek, you mentioned earlier, the variety of potential claims that all in one way or another have IP elements to them? Is there a prototypical example that you've been thinking about as you work on this this article?
I think there's an excellent example with the Lin case in that, I mean, when you look at it from kind of the 10,000-foot view, right? What happened was that Cisco was embarrassed, and because they, as Derek pointed out, they were supposed to be bulletproof. I think if Cisco could have sued Lin for embarrassing them, they would have. And really, what I saw as a security researcher was a translation into the legal world of, we are embarrassed. How can we stop this now? And so they used every possible legal method to make him stop talking about this very embarrassing fact.
And that would be the focus of your concern, that the law is being used in a way that prevents this discussion?
I brought this up as an example in the conference that you saw us at, which is that, in the same way that Larry Lessig says that that code is law on the internet, I say that the law is code, and it gets debugged by judges, and gets created by legislators. But these guys, these lawyers, these corporate attorneys, are essentially hacking the law. They're saying, look, we have a purpose. We need to protect our clients. How can we do this? And I think their claims were very disingenuous. And I think that any learned any judge should have said this is completely ridiculous. You guys are using the law for your own purposes. This is not what these laws were created to protect. And that is my concern, right? That, researchers, generally speaking, don't have attorneys, retained for these types of services, right? They usually, when they have, now at least, when they have some big, huge breakthrough that they need to talk about, there's huge, hoops that they have to, jump through. And there was another case where Alex Swartov found a problem with VeriSign, which is kind of the what runs SSL, right? This is like the technology that keeps e-commerce running. And he had to go through enormous pain and get Microsoft to act as a mediator just to safely talk about this huge, very important discovery. And I think this is a huge problem. I mean, the internet has become more and more important in our lives, not less. And so it should be easier and I think protected for researchers to be able to come forward with these discoveries, especially when they're doing it for the benefit of the public. These researchers are not, like Mike Lin didn't go forward and say, Cisco, give me $50,000 or I'm going to publicly disclose this. He did this under the direction of his employer, under the direction of ISS. And Cisco, you know, was able to basically silence him using laws that were meant to protect other things.
Derek, you know, what Oliver's saying, you know, and the focus of your article, I think, raises a fundamental question, which is whether, in fact, the law is preventing all of the socially valuable security research that about which you're concerned, which I think gets back to this basic idea of good hackers and bad hackers and white hat and black hat and so forth. You know, we see it in piracy on the copyright side that, you know, there are laws and they're quite clear with regard to piracy, and yet people will pirate anyway. Is there data, or do you have a sense that the law is significantly impeding the kind of socially valuable security research about which you're concerned? In other words, are people going to wind up, or especially hackers, going to wind up doing this anyway?
So it's a really interesting question, because when we think about things like intellectual property law in America is bound up with this idea of incentive. So what we want is the production of movies and books and, you know, cartoon characters and things along those lines. And so I am actually pretty confident that no matter what the law does, hackers are still going to be trying to break into systems for the intellectual challenge of it, because they regard it as fundamentally important, because they hate Microsoft, whatever their reason is. What worries me about this system is what they do with that information once they have it. The real problem that Oliver and I identify in this paper is this is a question of distribution. It's not about the generation of information. It's about what happens to it once it's out there. And unfortunately, hackers these days, you know, if you look at the difficulty that Oliver has outlined, right, in the SSL situation, if you have to jump through hoops, expose yourself to legal risk, hire a lawyer just to tell the vendor that you've actually found a flaw, or, on the other hand, you can sell your vulnerability on the underground in the black market for $25,000 or $50,000. Which of those might be more attractive if you're somebody who's operating on his or her own and, you know, needs to pay the rent? That's the worry. There is an opt-out for hackers that is a lot less socially valuable and socially attractive. And so in some ways, even conceding that there isn't a disincentive effect from these security laws or from IP laws that are sort of affecting security research, I'm worried not about whether or not people are going to produce information. I'm worried about what's going to happen to it once they've got that code sitting on their laptop.
We are talking with Professor Derek Bambauer and Oliver Day of the Harvard Berkman Center on Hearsay Culture on KZSU FM Stanford. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You could go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@ktsu.stanford.edu, and you will get a very happy response in return. I recognize that I'm making this plea at a time when there has been a massive catastrophe on the island of Haiti, where people's lives are in the balance, and so it's important for me to say that I'm not suggesting that you make your donation first to KZSU. Of course, there are many worthy causes, and certainly saving people, human beings, from immense suffering would trump any concern that I might have with respect to KZSU. But assuming that you are interested in making a donation to the radio station, notwithstanding greater immediate needs, I do hope that you consider making a donation to the radio station so it can continue its functions. Gentlemen, let's turn to the focus of your article. So, Derek, I'm glad that you pointed me in the specific direction that your article focuses, which is really the question, as you mentioned, of distribution, or what happens to the information after the work has already been done. So, just to be absolutely clear, is it your proposition? Have you seen that in fact most of the information is not going anywhere beyond what Oliver described as basically saying hidden, or as you're suggesting, being sold in the black market? Is there data to suggest that this is what is in fact occurring, or are you prescribing that this problem might occur if we don't deal with it now?
The difficulty really is that it's very, very hard to get data about things that either happen unlawfully or that don't happen at all. So the challenge of measuring a chilling effect is that you have to predict what would have happened in the absence of, say, IP law. In the same way, somebody who sells something to, say, the Eastern European mafia, right, in terms of it being a code vulnerability, is just not going to be likely to publicize that fact. So really, you know, what Oliver and I have tried to do is to talk informally with people in the community to get a sense. And so this is admittedly anecdotal. It's not empirically rigorous, but it's our strong belief that you do see greater trepidation on the part of larger sort of organized entities, you know, things a little smaller than perhaps iDefense Labs at VeriSign, but consulting companies and the like, and that you see individual researchers who do generate some of the really interesting insights out there starting to weigh this. What is it that they do with the information? So it's no longer automatically, yes, I should talk to the vendor. It's, let me think about my options, given that I have this risk hanging over my head. And in all likelihood, I think Oliver is just, you know, probably closer to the sort of source, and frankly, to the people who are doing this. So I'd want to get his take on this, too.
Yeah, Oliver, and I was going to ask you, I mean, when we talk about black market type transactions, I mean, who are the entities or individuals who are looking to buy this information?
It's definitely not a singular anymore. It's a plural. There's a marketplace for this type of information now. And, you know, in papers that I've read published in academic circles, you know, there's been defined marketplaces with very, very specific price lists for what's available and how much it's going to cost you, from credit card numbers to zero-day applications. And, you know, this is entirely speculation, but, you know, the recent break-in with Google involved zero-day with Internet Explorer. You know, it's quite likely that was purchased by, you know, that was purchased from some other researcher somewhere else. You know, it's the marketplace for crime on the Internet is very efficient in that you have people that are very specialized, and they know that they can do their thing that they're very good at and then take those results and sell them, and they will find a buyer, and the price, you know, will be very high. You know, Derek mentioned a $50,000 price tag. That's for a remote executable on Windows. That's a public price. That's what a legal corporation here in the United States, a subdivision of 3Com, will pay you if you find a zero-day vulnerability. Who knows what that's worth to, you know, the Eastern European mafia or to certain Asian, you know, spy rings. I mean, these things all have worth. And even in America, we have a legitimately created and publicly known cyber offensive division of our military now. So, you know, our government is also a buyer at this point. So, you know, we really have to ask, like, when a researcher finds something, where are they going to go with it? And you know, our laws are going to affect how they make their decision of where they're going to go. If they go to the vendor, you know, and they're afraid that they're going to get sued by the vendor, then they might not go there anymore, right? You know, and again, it's not uniform, right? Like with Microsoft, they have a very open policy, and PayPal has emailed me and said, we have a very open policy as well. We will not go after researchers if they follow the responsible disclosure protocol. Other vendors are not so clear about this. And as we saw with Cisco and, say, the MBTA, you know, they react vastly different than Microsoft. They'll come back and sue you for any number of reasons that researchers just don't know about. Like, we do not know all of these different laws that, my favorite was probably Virgil, Griffith, who was sued, Derek, was it the Lanham Act that he was sued under?
They actually did throw in trademark, which is just absolutely sort of brilliant, right? So it's standard lawyering. You basically throw everything against the wall and see what sticks. And the notion is just ridiculous. As Oliver said, this is hacking code. The idea that a security researcher has violated trademark law is just risible. Yet, nonetheless, it's the sort of thing that does convince judges, right? And so that's important, which is, you know, if you are somebody who's doing this kind of work, the three of us can have a really sort of interesting and nuanced discussion about this, and your listeners get this. A 70-year-old federal judge hears the word hacker, the first thing they do is reach for, you know, to issue a TRO. So that's part of our problem here, which is as they're thinking about this, just the mere fact of the type of research that, this community is doing and the fact that they get the label hacker means that they're already dealing with a disadvantage, not only from the law, but in terms of public perspective as well. So sorry, Oliver, I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
Oh, no, it's fine. That was actually I was hoping to hand it off to you for that.
Well, you know, it's a humorous and shocking use of intellectual property law to see the Lanham Act there, just as I've written about trade secrecy, and as I know you're familiar, trade secrecy getting in the way of state boards of elections being able to figure out how their voting machines work, and that the trade secrecy rights or alleged rights of the trade secret holder trump transparency and accountability in elections. We have a lot of strange areas where intellectual property seems to be intruding. Again, it's a personal interest of mine, and certainly of the listeners of the show. So Derek and Oliver, let me—I do want to come back to this idea of where a researcher goes with their particular research, and where they actually will ultimately find an outlet. You know, in your article, and we're going to talk about this in the remaining 17 or 18 minutes, the legal, social, and market-based potential reforms. You know, as you were talking about these kinds of black markets for this information, you know, it occurred to me as we look at the history of the major spies, at least in the last 50 years or 60 years, you take the Rosenbergs, for example, who sold atomic secrets, you know, presumably because of on ideological grounds to the Soviet Union. And contrast that with more recent spies like Aldrich Ames or Robert Hansen, who were not really ideologues, but did it for money. When we think about market-based solutions to where the information goes, putting aside intellectual property for a moment, how do you correct for the individual who's just going to sell it to the highest bidder?
It's a difficult problem, right? Which is, if you think about just pure compensation, I am not sure that vendors can ever outbid, people are going to use this for malicious purposes. And that's in some ways why, you know, this is sort of a classic move of sort of Larry Lessig's New Chicago School, which is that the market here is not the only mediating function. You have the norms of the hacker community, right, which tends to frown on sort of selling it to bad actors. You have the law operating in the background, which is there's at least a hint or the threat of greater penalties, particularly criminal penalties, if you do this. And you also have the potential that, right, to the degree that we can create a reasonably functioning, reasonably friendly, legitimate marketplace for this, we won't get everyone selling their information in what we think of as the right channels. But what we want to do is we want to tilt the table. We want to bias as many people who are on the margin to do the right thing as possible, and then really to allow things like criminal law and some of the criminal penalties that are available under IP law to take care of the genuinely bad actors.
So, gentlemen, and Oliver, I think I can ask you, what is the responsible disclosure model in the security community? What are its broad contours?
Yeah, I'm going to go out on a limb in trying to find this because it's still kind of under debate. People will. I mean, this is a 10-year-old debate in the security world, and people like John Viega, who's one of the VPs over at McAfee now. I mean, he's even weighed in recently in a book that he just published, and he's trying to model something new called smart disclosure. I mean, so it's still, again, it's very fresh. It's still ongoing, but essentially, what responsible disclosure means is that as a researcher, I find a flaw in a product. What the responsible protocol would be is for me to go to the vendor privately, disclose the vulnerability, and then give them a certain amount of time. And this is one of the problems with the definition is no one can really agree on the time frame. Generally, at least historically, it's been about 90 days. And the vendor has 90 days to basically respond, not to just fix it. I mean, they have to at least respond, acknowledge that it's a problem, that they are working on it. And if there's no movement in 90 days, or if they just flat out say, this is not something we're going to do, then and only then can the researcher go public. with the information. And really, the entire idea is that, you know, the goal is to get the vendor to fix the problem, not to embarrass the vendor, not to extort money. Money is actually not even a part of the protocol. It's just you have to give them a certain amount of time, and you don't disclose anything until the patch is released. Or if no patch is ever going to be released, then you go ahead and disclose it and try and get the community to fix the problem or to mount enough pressure on the vendor so that they will finally fix the problem.
Derek, what should the law do with this term hacker? It's something you had mentioned and I had mentioned, and you said you wanted to come back to it. We have about 14 minutes left, so you know, I'm not suggesting you take all 14 minutes, but what should that you know, that judge or a lawyer dealing with these issues do with that term?
Well, it's a really interesting question, because if you're the lawyer who's representing, let's say, a firm whose software has been hacked or whose voting machine has been hacked, you're going to deploy this term hacker as a tactic, and you're going to say, judge, these are hackers, right? We've all seen the movies, we've seen the net, we saw the Matrix. Like, these are bad and dangerous people, and as Oliver said, you know, they can sort of fly through virtual worlds and you know, break into our computers and so forth. It's a term that is in many ways scary, and there's an irony to this, because originally the sort of genesis of the term hacker was it was somebody who was interested in taking things apart to figure out how they worked and to see how they ran, finding flaws, making them run better, and so forth. It was really sort of normatively neutral. And both the sort of popular media view and, I would argue, the hacker community itself pushed in the direction of being edgier, a little bit darker, a little bit more dangerous. And that turns out to be, in some ways, a pyrrhic victory for the hacker community, which is all of a sudden now this is a term that's much more pejorative. So, again, Oliver makes the nice distinction between the term cracker, somebody who's sort of motivated by ill intent, and hacker, which is just somebody who's interested in sort of playing with and testing computers. And really, we think that there's two ways to deal with this. The first, and in my view, probably the less likely, is to try desperately to reclaim the original meaning of this term, to make a hacker back into this idea of much more neutral, someone who's an engineer, someone who's interested in sort of taking things apart in the way many of us took apart clock radios or old TVs in our youth just to see how they functioned. But I'm not sure that that's possible. And so one of the things Oliver and I have talked about is, can we find another term? And can we convince the community to start using this term? Is it security researcher? Is it private eye? We had somebody suggest gumshoe, which I kind of like. Is there some way of finding a different term that the community accepts and that then we can sort of pitch to the media as an antidote to this idea of hacker? I am not a hacker. I am blank, a security researcher, a cyber gumshoe, something like that. As a response, so when, you know, the attorney stands up and says, Your Honor, this person is a hacker and has broken into our systems, to say, no, I'm not. I'm a security researcher. And that just brings an entirely different connotation to it.
We're talking with Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School and Oliver Day of the Harvard Law School's Berkman Center, discussing their forthcoming article, The Hacker's Aegis, Protecting Software Security Research Against Intellectual Property. So gentlemen, you talk about, and this is an idea that I see discussed frequently, whenever sensitive data or information that maybe the entire public shouldn't have access to is discussed, and that's the idea of some kind of third-party ombudsman entity that would control information and allow it to be used in a public interest way without revealing it too broadly or in a way that would create potential downsides. So you talk in the article about in ways to deal with or to encourage not only the research, but again, the distribution of it, then a trusted third party would act as a coordinator for dealing with all of these vulnerability issues. It seems like a daunting task. Who or what do you have in mind to do that work, and how generally would it play out?
So from my perspective, what we're thinking of is, this is a little bit of thinking about what we talked about earlier, the market for information vulnerabilities. And if an economist looks at this market, they say, wow, there's a lot wrong here. There's all sorts of problems with gamesmanship. There's imperfect information. And then we have something that's really fun that we deal with in the intellectual property area a lot, which is Arrow's paradox, named after Kenneth Arrow, the Nobel laureate. And it's the idea that if I have a security vulnerability, say in Microsoft's Internet Explorer, I go to Microsoft and say, I've discovered a zero-day flaw. And they say, okay, well, we kind of don't believe you. We've never dealt with you before. Show it to us. But as soon as I do that, I've destroyed the value of the information to me. I can no longer monetize it because Microsoft says, thanks, now that we know about it, what do we owe you? And this means that any sort of forward-thinking security researcher is not going to want to do this. But by the same token, Microsoft's not going to pay them unless they can show the goods. The trusted intermediary is intended in some ways to bridge this gap, to overcome Arrow's paradox. And we see it in the intellectual property zone in areas such as the Hollywood Script Registry, right? Which is to essentially coordinate buyers and sellers, to provide reputational mechanisms, perhaps even to do some verification and some testing on its own. And we see that there actually are teams out there, such as the Computer Emergency Response Team, for example, at Carnegie Mellon, and Oliver knows them, a number of others, that could really play this role pretty readily.
And perhaps you could talk about that a little bit more, these groups. How do they operate, Oliver? Because that's a topic that we've discussed a little bit on the show, but they're an interesting sub-world in the situations that you describe.
Yeah, they all seem to operate individually, and I would love to see them kind of come together at this point. I think there's a lot of overlap at this point, but essentially they try and act as I think initially they tried to act just as archives, as this is a place, this is a repository where you can come and see historically what. And I apologize, there's a siren going by.
My son interrupted about 10 minutes ago, so there's a 3-year-old running around upstairs from the studio. So no worries, go on, please.
So historically it was this is a place where you could come and look and see all the flaws that have occurred in the past. And now I think because of the growing importance of these flaws, they're trying to become more proactive and become kind of intermediaries. And it kind of works, it kind of doesn't. Again, I think there's a little bit too much overlap at this point, and it would be nice if there was just a central point of contact that a researcher knew they could go to that would be a trusted party, that would be objective and wouldn't have commercial interest in it one way or the other. And those, right now, like with the certs and everyone else, they're all kind of nonprofit and they're great. And, on the other side, you have, the iDefenses and these kind of other vulnerability marketplaces where you can just go and commercially sell them. And interestingly, and just kind of based on what Derek was saying right now, there's, like with Microsoft, they don't actually pay you at all. Like there's, and this is kind of what I find to be the most interesting part of this debate is that, we've come to expect that researchers that are doing the right thing are going to keep doing it for free, and they do it because they can get some type of fame from it, and basically get cred, right? They get kind of a street cred, and then or industry cred, and what it usually translates into is a job somewhere doing this full time. That was great in the 90s when there wasn't a full marketplace that you could go and buy and sell these vulnerabilities. Now I think it really complicates things and in my mind makes this discussion way more important, because if we don't incentivize people to do the right thing, as Derek says, they can easily go and then profit off of it. And what we're hoping to do is make it to where if we have this third party that is objective and doesn't have commercial interest, they can help steer people to continue doing the right thing for free, and hopefully security researchers will feel compelled to go and work with these organizations.
We're talking with Professor Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School and Oliver Day of Harvard's Berkman Center. Gentlemen, we have about 4 minutes left, and this is where I generally start asking unfair questions. And by unfair, I mean we don't have enough time for you to give a great answer or a complete answer, so I'm going to ask you for kind of the nutshell answer. But this is, and it's also unfair because I'm asking you to pull out a crystal ball. With regard to these three broad areas, where you are proposing reforms, legal, social, and market-based. I guess I'll ask each of you, and I'll start with Derek. Pull out your crystal ball and tell me, which one do you think of the three is most likely to have legs, and which one do you think, say, 5 years from now is going to still be an uphill battle? Or maybe none of them will be easy, but I'll ask you that kind of ranking.
interesting. I think the most manageable is the market-based one, and it's because it really can operate based on the self-interest of the parties that are involved. So you have a software community that increasingly sees the value of the work done by independent researchers, right? So as Oliver mentioned right at the top, Microsoft is a convert. You still see firms like Oracle as holdouts, but there are an increasing number of large software companies that collaborate with this community, that are sort of opening things, not necessarily open source, but greater access to source and things like that. And so I think that to the degree they recognize it's in their own business interest and the interest of their customers, clients to do this, the market-based mechanism is the easiest. Frankly, the social one I am pessimistic about, in part just because the community that we most need to do this is the software security community, right? And these folks are just famously independently minded. They don't even agree, as Oliver pointed out, on responsible disclosure. I have no doubt that somebody's going to call into your show or email you and just excoriate Oliver based on how he described in the sort of 50,000-foot level. Responsible disclosure. So getting them to agree on a single term and to use it consistently, I think, is very unlikely. And sadly, I'm a little pessimistic about the legal reforms as well, which is the trend in American worldwide, I would argue, is towards intellectual property maximalism, that we see augmentation not only of the scope of IP law, but in the penalties that are assessed for its breach. And so even though I think highly, obviously, of our proposal for a safe harbor on the merits, I think it suffers some significant political choice problems in terms of actually getting it passed. So I think in 5 years, we might not see the clearinghouse that we propose, but we'll see a better market, a better legitimate market for vulnerabilities. But I don't know that we'll have made all that much progress on either the legal or social fronts.
Oliver, you agree, disagree, have a different view?
I agree almost entirely. I definitely think the marketplace is more predictable and is much stronger and has a much better chance of being robust. Now, I'm not really sure how to rank the other two. I agree that, yeah, the security community can't really agree on very much these days or ever, really. And I would probably say that, for at least from my perspective, and maybe it's because I haven't gotten through law school or even attended, but... I feel like with the legal reforms, you need to have someone that is pushing for the reform and not just, you know, a security researcher and a law professor. I think you need to have money and a lobbyist group. You know, that seems to be how laws are created in our country. And certainly the intellectual property holders have those things, and they have been doing a wonderful job of protecting their rights. Unfortunately, the security community, because they can't agree on anything, will never have this. At least in my mind, at least not in the next 5 years. And so it seems difficult, a very big uphill battle for them to get these rights established to protect them when they can't really seem to agree that they need the protection or how to get that going.
You know, it's we close here, other than my last question to ask you about where people can learn about what you do. But, you know, it occurs to me as the U.S. military launched the site recently, I think it's forge.mil, where they are actually engaging certain members of the public in open discussion and almost really collaboration in a variety of defense-related technologies, that, you know, there is some hope that that perhaps more information sharing will occur. But I think in your article, and I look forward to reading it in its final form, you've identified a significant problem, and I think the approach from the perspective of what happens to the information as opposed to the incentives is as a general matter in IP, I think, underexplored. And I think in this area, I venture to say, without canvassing all of the literature, that you're making a significant contribution, because it probably hasn't been discussed in any great detail. Gentlemen, I will ask you in the remaining 30 or so seconds, Derek, and I'll start with you, for people that want to learn more about what you do or what you write, where can they go?
The best place is probably my blog, which is actually hosted by the Berkman Center, which is called InfoLaw. So it's blogs.law.harvard.edu/infolaw, and you'll get to me.
And Oliver, any other places where we can find out more about what you're doing?
I work primarily out of stopbadware.org, and we're really focused on consumer level, not corporate level, but we are at stopbadware.org.
Derek Bambauer of Brooklyn Law School, joining us by telephone from Brooklyn, as well as Oliver Day, joining us by cell phone. I'm going to guess you're in Boston, Oliver, but you could be anywhere. We'll leave it at anywhere. Fair enough. From the Berkman Center, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. I really enjoyed the discussion, and I invite you both back to further the discussion as events warrant.
That would be fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dave. This has been absolutely fascinating.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests upcoming on Hearsay Culture for the remaining portion of the winter quarter, which has just begun. Next week, Kazis Varnelis from Columbia University will be on discussing his edited books, Networked Public. Professor Manuel Castells of the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communication will be on discussing communication power. I'm very excited to have Professor Castells on the show. Professor Chris Kelton of the University of California, Los Angeles, author of a variety of works, but the most recently, Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Free Software, will be on the show. In mid-February, Professor Beth Novak of New York Law School, who's currently serving as the Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the White House Office of Science and Technology, will be on. Beth is also a patent law scholar and has written extensively in transparency generally, and now she's putting her estimable skills towards governmental transparency, so I'm excited to have Beth on in February. Professors Daniel Citron of University of Maryland School of Law and Frank Pasquale of Seton Hall Law School will be on discussing fusion centers, a fascinating outgrowth of the Department of Justice on the state and local level, where a variety of data from public and private sources are being data mined for, frankly, who knows what. So now I'm looking forward to that discussion as well. Into March, Professor Shubha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin Law School will be on discussing his work. And then closing out the quarter will be Laura DeNardis, the Executive Director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, who wrote a great book last year called Protocol Politics, The Globalization of Internet Governance. There are some other guests that will be coming up later on in the year, but as always, I invite you to offer any suggestions for guests you'd like to hear on Hearsay Culture or any comments on the show by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. As always, you have a variety of ways you can listen to this show. You can, of course, listen to it live 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU. You can also get the show by podcast, either by going to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you will find not only Hearsay Culture, but events at CIS. You can also pick up the show by going to Stanford's CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can also pick up the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can pick up all, at this point, I think 107 previous shows, as well as check out the schedule of upcoming guests and occasional blogging on my part. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.